Hello, everybody. I'm Jamie Cullum. And I've got taller. Sorry, I thought we'd throw that in. How lovely to see you. Right, he's out there, so I won't delay too much. Give us a wave, will you? Because we're all this. Thank you. I'm Nigel Williams. I'm the Breakfast Show presenter at Jazz FM. Now, we like that. Jamie and I actually were just talking, because we go like way back to the 90s when he was first turning up in reception at Jazz FM with his cassettes of his demos of his music that he made. So we are here to give you that little insight then into what it's like to be somebody like who's come into the Discovery tent for Yamaha today and had a go, but then managed to make it a bit more than that, and just having the energy or the guts just to try it out. And Jamie's a great mentor to new musicians as well, having now had the success himself. So without further ado, let's bring on Jamie Cullum. You all right, then?
I'm very well. I hope this many people turn up for the gig later.
No, it's brilliant. It's actually your second time at the festival, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I played here a few years ago. It's amazing to watch it grow and amazing to see just how many bands there are that can play here that people want to see now. Because I think the audience for music that is related to jazz has just got bigger and better, and everyone's waking up to how good the scene is, basically, which is amazing.
So I think when you came here first time round, that was 5 years ago, by the way, you got up on stage and you did a little thing. You actually created a song and it was Love Supreme, I will see you next year. And then it was 5 years, you're coming back with this album, Taller. And you were telling me, really, this has been, you've been just trying to cook this up for years itself, very personal album.
Yes, there is that phrase, isn't there, that kind of life gets in the way. I think it didn't get in the way in a bad way. It's just that, you know, I have had two children now. I have a lovely wife, and I think because my career, I started really playing professionally from the age of about 17, 18, and when I finished uni, things moved quite quickly for me, and really, I kind of never stopped. I just kept on with that forward momentum. And I think when you're a jazz musician at the core, you don't rely on that same, you make an album, you tour it, you go away, you make an album, you tour it, you go away. You just, if there's a gig, you go and play it. And you know, even if it's not just your band. So I think when I started to think about this album 4.5 years ago, I think I just needed to take a step back because I wrote some material. And actually what I found was that the material, it was just a bit lacking. Something about it, when I listened back to the stuff that I was making, it just felt like it was missing. It didn't kind of befit a man who was about to kind of enter the final part of his 30s. It's a bit like the pop star who still writes songs about going to the club when he's like 60, which is the best way I could describe it, although yeah. I still like going to the club. I just felt like I wanted to really cook something up that that felt fresh, and I chose to do that by focusing on the words before the music. I've always focused first on the music and then added the words in afterwards. And this time, I basically wrote poems really and set them to music. So that's how this one came about.
You were saying that you lost your confidence.
Yeah,
in this. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, because if we're going to have like a theme of developing as a musician, having that the guts to take it from just messing about in your bedroom to maybe playing in front of an audience to joining a band, that kind of thing. How do you cope with something like that when you're questioning yourself so much?
Well, confidence is a really interesting one for me. I've had quite a odd relationship with confidence because I wasn't a naturally confident teenager, I think I was like any other teenager in a lot of ways. I had my own kind of hang-ups and I had my own bits of confidence here and lack of confidence there. But music was something that gave me a lot of self-esteem as a teenager. It was kind of my thing. You know, it wasn't football, it wasn't maths, it wasn't being a ladies' man, sadly. It was the fact that I could play guitar, I could play piano, and I knew a lot about music. And so, but yeah, as I went on through my music career, I remember really very vividly when 20 something came out and a lot of the press were writing about it, particularly the jazz press, and saying, well, he's not really an accomplished jazz musician, he's more of an entertainer. And I really took that stuff quite hard in those days.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I knew I wasn't a technical master. That was never what I came to the table with. I kind of, what I knew was is that I was able to bring a lot of things together with passion, but I didn't go to music school. I can't read music to this day. I still do everything by ear, although I'm trying to change that now. And so during that time, I had to develop confidence just through my own, just every time I do a gig, if I looked out there and saw people were enjoying it and connecting to what I did, I was like, well, that's got to be enough. You know, if you're communicating something to the people in the audience, you realize as you go on, that's all it's about. If you're creating a connection, whether you do it by being the most technical person or a very untechnical person, whether you're Nick Cave or Bob Dylan, or whether you're Keith Jarrett or Oscar Peterson, do you know what I mean? There are different ways of creating a connection. And it took me a long time to figure out what it is that I bring to the table. But the lack of confidence around this time was more from, I think I told myself I wanted to be a songwriter above and beyond anything. I wasn't bothered about being called a jazz musician or a piano player or a singer or any of these things. I just wanted to write great songs. And I felt like I wasn't trying hard enough and I wasn't accessing enough authenticity or honesty to write really good songs.
So you wanted to write a monster?
I did.
Definitely. No, because you became famous, your incredible covers, you know, High and Dry, Radiohead, Don't Stop the Music. I mean, there are just so many of them, and you applied the Jamie Cullum magic to those kind of things, and those have been some of your biggest successes. So there must have been something in you that said, yeah, but I really want it to be my stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the covers thing is an interesting one, and I've got quite a showbiz story about that, because when I made, I was making the album Catching Tales, which is right after 20-something, I said to myself, I can't do covers anymore. I've got to prove I'm a songwriter, so I'm going to write all these songs. And around the time I was working on Catching Tales, 20-something got nominated for a Grammy, and it blew my mind. And then my press agency called me and said, Elton John wants to interview you for Interview magazine. And all this was blowing my mind. I didn't know what to do. And I spoke to the great man on the phone. And he said to me, you know what? You're writing really great songs. But he said, so few people can do good covers. And he said, don't forget that doing covers is an art form. From one of the greatest songwriters in the world, he said, you know, being able to sing other people's songs and make them your own is really, really an art form, and you do it so well.
Wow.
Yeah. So I took a great deal of encouragement from that.
That'll bring us on to Rocket Man, won't it? Which
yes.
You actually performed in front of Elton and Bernie.
I did. Yes.
Tell us about that then.
So it was the Ivor Novello Awards, and a lot of people had to perform Elton John songs in front of Elton John, and one by one, I watched everyone forget the words. Daniel Bedingfield, Mary J. Blige, everyone was like, I think the reason why he liked mine so much was because I basically remembered how to play the song. But you know, the covers thing, I've been doing this on YouTube, it's called The Song Society, where one of the things that really tipped my career over to another level, and actually it's quite a good bit of advice for any musicians that are in the audience, taking chances is such an important thing. I was asked when I got when 20-something was at its peak. I was asked to go on Radio 1 on the Joe Wiley show to do the Live Lounge, and a lot of people were saying, "Well, why is he going on Radio 1? He's not a Radio 1 artist." And they said, "You know, we want you to do one of your songs, and then can you do a cover?" And they were trying to give me joke covers to do. And of course, I've always been a massive hip hop fan. I said, "Oh, I'd quite like to do that song Frontin' by Pharrell." And they were like, "You're going to do Frontin' by Pharrell?" I'm like, "Yeah." And so we only had about an hour to get it together before the show, but we did it. And it was such a success that Pharrell ended up hearing it, and I went and worked with Pharrell in Miami after that. I worked on his solo album called... I worked on his solo album In My Mind, and it was a real example of not listening to, you know, the critics, not listening to people who are trying to think that you're doing something that you shouldn't be. I just kind of went with it, and, you know, Pharrell, I guess... He just heard some kid from Chippenham doing a doing a version of like his song Frontin', yeah. And was like, "What is, you know?" It was, we made a really great connection then.
Can we wind the clock right back then to being a kid? You said you were like 17, 18 when you started playing professionally. Was that for the pizza and the Peroni? Was that the
that no? Role? That was a bit later. So
that was a bit later.
I was in various rock bands at school. The first one was called Raw Sausage. And we did almost exclusively AC/DC covers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And we had
four guitarists and one drummer. yeah. So and then we did Nirvana covers, and we did Rage Against the Machine covers, and we had one song called High Voltage, which is a name of an AC/DC song. We wrote our own version of it. So I was doing that for ages, and then I was starting to play a lot of piano as in my later teens, and my girlfriend at the time was working at a local hotel, and she said the piano player has died, and there was a staff meeting, and the manager said, if anyone knows a local piano player, you can take over. Let's. And she said, oh, my boyfriend plays, and I said, but I only know three songs. She said, well, no one really listens anyway, but they're going to pay you. They're going to pay you 25 quid for 4 hours. I'm like, 25 quid for 4 hours? All right. And so I did that. And by the second week, I knew 10 songs. By the third week, I knew 20 songs. And 2 years later, I knew 200 songs, you know?
Wow, that's fair. Tell me about lessons. Isn't that good now?
I can't remember any of them. Sorry.
You said that you know, as a teenager, you weren't necessarily a ladies' man, but when you started playing all these instruments, right, did you find that coolness of being in a band worked for you? I mean,
not really.
No?
No.
They always go for the drummer, don't they?
Well, I'm just trying to think. I'm trying to think of an honest answer to that. My very, very good friend Mark is here tonight, and we used to go out and see all these bands when we were the only people who wanted to go and see people. Like, we went to New York to see Woody Allen play and to see Kurt Elling play and to go to the Village Vanguard to experience jazz, right, when we were 19. And a lot of our friends were like, what are you doing? You know, everyone was going to like Tenerife and, you know, and I love that. Don't get me wrong. I loved doing that stuff too, but we spent our money to go and do that. And it was, we just wanted to experience it. I couldn't quite put my finger on why, but it definitely was not something that made girls attracted to you. But I think gradually what I realized is that I think if you're passionate about something and it's a truthful passion, it doesn't, I think musicians are successful with in love, or people are attracted to them if they are doing something that they are doing because they need to and want to do it. I think that in itself is attractive. Not if you're doing it because you know you're going to get more chicks.
Yeah, or you got a great haircut or something. Yeah. So let's talk about that break then from playing, doing little piano hits and things like that to or gigs. To actually striving to be a recording artist. Now, I know that you used to turn up at Jazz FM years back with a little cassette.
I'm not sure whether that's true or not. I don't know whether that was me. It could well have been.
Yeah. And then, so you've got to want to do that, but you've also got to believe it's possible. What was that like for you, that process of, like, you know, I'm going out playing gigs, but I really want to be able to make an album one day.
I think I was in hiding to some degree because I would pretend to myself that I didn't want it. But I think now I can look back and see that I probably did. And I got a lot of gigs very quickly because, you know, I was young in a scene that around the time and the era I was playing around kind of Wiltshire, that kind of area. You know, there was an amazing jazz scene, but there weren't many young people playing, at least not that I came in contact with. So I used to get all the gigs. I could play piano, I could sing, and I knew loads of songs, and I was cheap. And, you know, so I got a lot of gigs, so I didn't have to think about it for a while. But really, when I made my first CD, the impetus to make it was to make a bit of extra money at gigs, because I realized after every gig, people say, have you got a CD? And I thought, God, if I had a CD, I could have sold three tonight. That's 30 quid, you know. So I made a CD for that reason. But I didn't. It's funny you say about turning up to Jazz FM with tapes, because I don't remember that. But maybe that is true. Maybe I've written it out of my memory. But I do remember having that CD that I made 300-400 copies of.
Yeah.
And I gave it to Claire Teal, for example, yep. who I knew from Bath and Bristol. And she took it to Candid Records. And I could feel just people started to want to have meetings with me. And I thought, well, if I can do it on my own terms, as long as I can do it on my own terms, that I have to sell out, they're not going to make me, you know, wear this or do that or go and sing with so-and-so, I thought I'll go with it. But really my ambition at that stage was to play in other people's bands, to be a session guy for like some really good band and play it like Ronnie Scott's, really. That was kind of it. That
amazing.
I thought if I get to do that on my own terms, then I've won, you know?
Well, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And so... So the Michael Parkinson chat show break, was that really where today we'd say went viral? Was that really your breaking point?
It was to the mainstream media, definitely, because I think I was prepared musically. So whilst I was nervous about being on television, my haircut and my clothes were not prepared at all. So I wasn't TV ready in that sense. But I knew I could sit with my trio and play a really good version of a standard. So I managed to hold it together. It was also the night that Meg Ryan and him had a fight. So even more people watched it than usual. And then suddenly there's this kid who looks like he should still be in Raw Sausage. Turning up and playing an old song, and it definitely, you know, it kicked things to another level. But
were you nervous?
I was absolutely bricking it. Yeah, totally, totally. But I think again another key thing for anyone out there who's making music: the more gigs you can do and the more experience you can have, it means that when you have those moments that matter, however nervous you are, you'll be able to pull it off. I think. You know, you look at the kind of X Factor situation where you go from your bedroom to live television. And I think many people do that very well. But I think, wow, you haven't had that experience of playing in a pub to four people or, you know, whatever.
So would you recommend going to the singers' nights and things like that?
Absolutely. I think they're essential. And I think not only are they essential to go to, they're essential for any, like, pub person or art centre person to host, because it's the only place where you can develop any kind of stagecraft is on an actual stage.
How about making mistakes? Because none of us are perfect. Mm. So how do you deal with that? You know, for somebody who's going out to do those gigs and then they forget the words.
I do that all the time. I make up the words. I get fans to Google the words to my own songs while I'm on stage. I think this need for perfection is really boring. And I think we're human, and I mean, as long as it's not like completely ramshackle, but forgetting things and making mistakes, particularly when you're a musician, I think it's more. I think it's more interesting, really. So, don't worry about making mistakes.
You did this, yeah. There we go.
Make more mistakes.
Now recently you did this really cool thing, and that was that you did this first ever 5G live concert. Yeah. So you were in London, King's College, I think it was, wasn't it? And then various parts of the band were scattered around the country, but they were amateurs, weren't they?
They were, yeah. So they were, I mean, yeah, amateur musicians, not professionals, but they were high standard. A couple of them were in music college, a couple of them were just doing like local gigs and stuff. So yeah, we had like a music lesson and a jam session over 5G, which was very, very weird, but it was great. It worked really well, actually.
So it works because there's very little delay, so you're able to, everybody could hear and see everything.
There's the same amount of delay as there is us speaking here, that's which is incredible. Obviously inaudible to apart from the flies that are in here, if there are any. Yeah.
And so you were mentoring these people sort of, you know, via the internet, if you like, or via the 5G network. And I noticed you do that in a very positive way, and you're actually, you know, bigging them up. Whether this bit you did really well, this one, and I could see people responding to that. It was great. It was almost like you were giving them that confidence to maybe go wrong at some point. You know, take a leap. It's like jump in the water. It might not be, and maybe drown a bit because you'll know what it's like.
Exactly. I think that's exactly what it should be. But I also think that if you are a performer, you need to, I think encouragement is one thing, but I think you also have to accept that things will go wrong and you will finish gigs and feel terrible. You know, that happens to everyone. It's a bizarre process and a bizarre thing to do for a living. But, you know, my role in that situation is to encourage. But I always think for musicians, you only get good output if you have good input. And when I say that, I mean, if you're a musician, you should be going to gigs, you should be watching other gigs, you should be listening to great music, you should be reading great books, you should be watching great films, putting good stuff in, and that will, you develop a language. So creating that kind of positive aura around music and listening and just general like art and culture, just bringing it all into your world, and hopefully you get something good out of it.
Yeah, and you did that with a charity called Music for All, didn't you? Which gives opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, good people. So, let's come back to tonight's gig. What's on?
What is on? That's a good question. Yeah. I should probably know.
Any
that
requests?
By now, shouldn't I? Yeah. Exactly. Well, we're going to play some stuff from the new album, but I think what I love about the band that I have and the way that we don't have a set list. So I definitely know I'm going to play a few things, but I change things on the fly. You'll notice, because my bass player doesn't know whether he's supposed to play electric or acoustic bass, and they're quite different instruments. So sometimes I'll have to start a couple of bars in. But I think keeping it free flowing like that is one of the strong points of our live show, because we can react to how I think it's feeling and where I think it should go.
Okay, so these guys, they will have to be directing you tonight.
Oh, I don't know whether I'll listen to them that closely.
We have a few minutes left, and I was thinking maybe put your hand up if you've got a question for Jamie. You, sir?
Hi, Jamie. Hello there. So, out of all the artists or bands that have passed or that are with us currently, which one are you still longing to really perform with and have that opportunity to play with?
Yeah, there's quite an easy answer to that question. The artist I'd like to have played with most is Prince, actually. I think the thing about Prince is that he encompassed everything I think a performer could be in terms of musicianship, kind of a kind of dogged approach to just his artistry, but also as an entertainer as well. So he was like everyone rolled into one. And I did a jam session 1 year in America with The Roots, which was amazing. And as I walked onto stage, Prince was just coming off stage, and I was like, please no, then I can tick it off my list. But it was not to be.
Your, because you, of course, have a radio show at some radio station up the road from us.
An inferior one.
How has that, how has that helped you as a musician? Because you've been exposed to stuff that perhaps you otherwise wouldn't have listened to, I guess.
Definitely. I mean, I think I'm a rabid consumer of other people's music, so I'm always, so that in some ways the radio, I don't think that automatically makes you a good radio presenter, and I've said this to you before, you don't realise how hard being on the radio is until to make it sound easy is a very hard thing to do. It's obviously something you do amazingly well, and it's taken me a long time to start to get, you know, really comfortable on the radio, but I listen to other people's music all the time. That's no exaggeration. I'm always got new interesting stuff on, and I think for me the most interesting part has been getting to meet a lot of the people, you know, from Dave Brubeck to Winton to Ahmad Jamal to Robert Glasper, Common, all the various people that I've interviewed that I may not have had the chance to meet. And you realise with the people that are so focused and have such an amazing approach to their whole career, that they all are all they're all staying curious. When I interviewed Dave Brubeck, it was right before he died. We did this beautiful interview, and he was 85, 86 at the time. He just played the Newport Jazz Festival, and I said to him casually, "So what are you doing when you go home? Are you going back on the road?" He goes, "No," he said, "I'm home for a week, and I'm going to do a week of practice. I need to practice for the next week before I go back out on the road again." And I'm just like, that's all you need to know. You know, I think the real artists are the ones that just stay curious and don't stop.
Do you practice?
I do. Yeah, I practice. I'm a big fan at the moment of, you know, YouTube, in the sense of the amount that you can learn. I'm starting to learn finally about harmony and music theory, mainly on YouTube, actually. So yeah, it's coming.
And you
together.
Said you've got like an app on your iPod and thing, oh, iPad, and
I've got something called Staff Wars, which looks like Star Wars, but it's teaching you to sight read notes. Yeah.
And is that working for you? I mean, I have asked you this question before, but not in front of this audience. If you are somebody that is ear-led, so you obviously have a great creativity, when you learn the nuts and bolts of it, could that be a hindrance, maybe?
Absolutely not. I think that's a kind of urban legend. I think expertise trumps passion.
Shall we take an from the back? Put your hand up if you've got a question for Jamie. You, sir?
I did play the White House, yeah.
Most memorable person you met at the White House?
So had the chance to play at the White House. It was International Jazz Day. So, I mean, the people that I met there that I was, I couldn't believe I was meeting. Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, Al Jarreau, Aretha Franklin. I met her. She was wearing her kind of pre-stage tracksuit. And she looked amazing, and she was so sweet. She was really, but she had an aura about her that was like, you know, if you're not a good musician, then why are you here? And so when she was sitting about where this gentleman is sitting right now, as I started to play, and she was sitting there like this. And I started to play, and she looked over the person sitting next to me, and she went like this, she went. I was like, fuck. So.
I'm going out on a limb here, but I know we've only got you have to be absolutely bang on time because it's a festival. So could we encourage you to tinkle the ivories just a little for us before you go? It's a little song that goes something like this.
Oh, are you going to join in?
No.
Well, I'd sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near. In spite of the warning voice that comes in the night, it repeats how it yells in my ear. Don't you know, you fool, that you never can win? Use your mentality, wake up to reality. And each time that I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin, 'cause I've got you. Under my skin, I've got you. Under my skin, I've got you, deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me. And I've got you. You know the reason why I'm playing this one? You want to know why? You know when I got that first hotel gig?
Oh, yeah.
This is the one song I knew how to play.
Yeah. There you go.
I've tried so not to give in, and I've said to myself, this affair is never gonna go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well
So I've got you under my skin. Why sacrifice anything? Come what might, for the sake of having you near, in spite of the warning voice comes in the night and repeats how he yells in my ear. Don't you know, you fool, that you never can win? Use your mentality, wake up to reality. And each time that I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin. Cause love supreme, I've got you. Oh, I've got you. Oh, Nigel, I've got you. Oh, in your stripy jacket. Oh, Yamaha, I love you. Please, can I have another free piano? Oh, cause I love ya. Cause I've got you. Under my skin.
Jamie Cullum! Hey, here's the guy. Back up keyboards. That was quite good, wasn't it? Hey, let me introduce you to this gentleman. Have a seat on the thing here. All right. So I was talking about the 5G gig, and Jamie, I did know that you were going to be here, actually. And Jamie just pointed you out. What's your name, sir?
My name's Taylor Paisley French.
What's that name? Taylor, tell us about... Because you did backup keyboards, yeah?
Yeah, keys and vocals.
So you were... Where were you? Were you Birmingham or Bristol?